Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and we've got my mother, Caroline Kilburn, on the other end of the line.
Yes, it's another beautiful, another beautiful day. Going to be a little warm here. I hope that everybody's
having a little, you think?
Summer has arrived.
You think? This would be a very warm, I'd be dealing with some of the issues that we're going to be talking about today.
Yes.
Yeah. We have with us, we're going to have two guests today, but they're both regarding the same project, which is the documentary and the book, Period, End of Sentence, A New Chapter in the Fight for Menstrual Justice. And first we have with us Anita Diamond. Am I saying your name correctly?
Yes, you are.
All right. Anita Diamond, who is the New York Times bestselling author of The Red Tent and The Boston Girl, and she's also the author of three other novels, a collection of essays, Pitching My Tent, and six nonfiction guides to contemporary Jewish life. She has been published in many, many periodicals, newspapers as well, and you can find out more about Anita and her books at AnitaDiamond.com. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Anita.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
So The Red Tent is kind of, in my mind at least, the book that put you on the map.
Yes, it did.
And tell us a little bit about why you wrote that, and for those who aren't familiar with it, what it's about.
Well, The Red Tent was published in 1997, and it's a retelling of a very tiny mention in Genesis, in the Bible. The sole daughter of Jacob and Leah is mentioned. Her name is Dinah. And there's a few sentences, a few lines about her in the Bible about how she is supposedly raped, and there's a tremendous amount of hell to pay as a result of that. I wrote this book, in the Bible she doesn't say anything, she doesn't have a single word, and I wrote the book from her perspective, in her voice, and described the world as I imagined she lived in, a world of women, of mothers, of women's work. And it's called The Red Tent because I created this idea of a menstrual tent where the women would gather during their periods and when they gave birth. And it was a place not of banishment and punishment, but of support and rest. So that that book caught fire, thanks really to book groups, which I am continually grateful to, and also to independent bookstores who cherished it and recommended it to people. And it became a bestseller, and it's in over 25 languages, and it continues. I still get lovely emails from readers around the world.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
Great.
Now, was that concept of the red tent something that was historically accurate?
No.
Or do we not know?
Oh, we don't know. No. Well, it's not impossible. I think that's the key to successful historical fiction, is that it's not impossible that there was such a thing. There have been and continue to be menstrual tents and huts in pre-modern and indigenous cultures around the world. And so it's not impossible that there was such a thing. So I embroidered on that idea and tried to make it as realistic as I could, given what I knew about that historical period. But I did invent it. And certainly it would not have been red. It would have been made, in my telling, it was made out of the reddish hair from goats, so it was kind of a reddish hue, so it wasn't one of those, it wasn't vermilion or anything like that.
Yeah. So, are you a historian?
No.
No? Because you get these...
I'm a journalist and a writer of stories, so no, but I do as much historical research as I possibly can so that there are no terrible anachronisms, so there's nothing that anybody could read through the book and go, oh, that's impossible, or that's historically incorrect. So I want it to be possible when I write historical fiction. So that means researching what people were wearing and where they lived and what their homes looked like, what they were eating. My fiction focuses on women's lives, and women's lives are for the most part, have been focused around family and home and hearth and taking care of other people and what that looks like. And that's a kind of history that's really sadly lacking because, you know, women didn't write history, and our monuments are made out of bread and babies, and those don't last. So you really have to dig deep into whatever social history you can to come up with those stories. It's gotten better and better over the years as more women have taken on history and spent the time and effort to find what they could about women's lives.
And, of course, you've contributed to that, I believe, to that effort. So, Anita, how did you get involved in this project, period, end of sentence?
I was invited, actually, by the PAD project, the people who created the Oscar-winning movie, period, end of sentence, which in 2019 won the Oscar for Best Short Documentary, which I saw. I watched the Oscars and was excited and thrilled when a movie about periods won an Oscar. And the next day I watched the film on Netflix at the time, and you can watch it now on YouTube. And I was really impressed. I thought it was great. And then a few months later, I got a phone call from my agent asking if I would be interested in talking to the PAD Project about working on a book, not about the movie, but sort of a book inspired by the film about menstrual justice and menstrual injustice. And it's something I have written about as a journalist, and I didn't have a project at the moment, and I said yes. That's how it happened.
And then COVID
hit. And I wrote this during COVID. This was a COVID book, a COVID baby. So the research was clearly virtual. But this is a global book, and the internet at this point is a real treasured trove of information and connection. You know, when I wrote The Red Tent, the internet was in its infancy. It was totally worthless as a resource for research. But now, it connects you with people around the world who are working on this subject, fighting the good fight to improve lives for people who menstruate. And so I did some phone interviews as well, and I read as many books as I possibly could about the subject. And so that was my project, and I'm very grateful I had something to do during COVID. I think I would have gone nuts otherwise.
The internet really has changed how books are researched and probably has impacted the quality of books, because a lot of that information that you're putting in, it might have taken you months and months and years to find.
Absolutely. That's absolutely
previously.
True. And the internet, for all of the downsides, and there are many, is also part of the struggle for menstrual justice. It has connected people, especially young people around the world, and let them know that they are part of a large movement, and that there are people around the world who are working as hard as they can in whatever ways they can to improve a lot of people who menstruate, so that there's the real question here is about dignity, that one should be able to take care of one's necessary bodily functions in dignity. And that is sorely lacking in many, many places around the world, and not just, you know, in poorer countries, but in your very own zip code. So the internet does create a sense of solidarity and shared information, for that matter.
Absolutely. So, Mom, do you have some questions?
Well, it's beyond comprehension, you know, that it's looked upon as a looked down on by humanity, that we have a menstrual period. I mean, what in the world is wrong with men that they don't understand that without that there wouldn't be any children?
Right. Well, actually, yeah, men are responsible for a lot of the suffering, but men are mostly in the dark about menstruation because we don't talk about it. They don't know. There's a great story in the book that when Sally Ride, the first woman to go into outer space, remember? The rocket scientists came to her, and she was going to be up there for a week, and they came to her and said, is 100 tampons enough? So these are not stupid men, but they have absolutely no clue what a period is or how long it lasts or what it might be like, even though I'm sure many of them had some experience with wives and daughters. So So that's how little they know.
So getting it out into the open, talking about it is what can bring about change.
Absolutely.
And that's what this book is about, is trying to make it, you know, that we can have the show and talk about it, not feel embarrassed. I mean, I remember the time. I'm past the point of having to worry about it, mm-hmm. now, but you know, I certainly remember being embarrassed and, oh, nobody, I don't want anyone to see that I'm taking a tampon out of my purse when I go to the bathroom. And do you feel like that is changing among younger women now?
I think it's starting to. I do. There are models of this now of women and girls. I really want to shout out to kids as young as 13 who refuse to be ashamed about this, and who, and a friend of mine's daughter said, came home from school one day and said, "Why am I supposed to hide my pads? What is that all about? Why?" And her mother said, "Well, no one's ever asked that question before, really." And she said, "Well, I'm not going to do it." And she didn't, you know, and I know this girl, and she's just started college, and I'm sure she doesn't hide anything about who she is. So I feel like there is that voice in the world, all over the world. There was in India, there's a story of a cleric who put up a sign on his temple, on his Hindu temple, that women of menstruating age were not allowed into the temple because the potential of their bleeding would somehow, you know, pollute the place. And there was a huge outcry online, started by a young college woman who started a hashtag happy to bleed. And it caught on, I don't know how many thousands and thousands of times it was shared and repeated all over India and Southeast Asia and shared around. And I learned about it, obviously, so it's around the world. So there's a sense of self-awareness that there's something fundamentally wrong with the idea that we should be ashamed of, as you said just now, a function without which there would be no human beings.
It's isn't it interesting? It's like a lot of people are more willing to talk about sex than they are about periods.
And erectile dysfunction.
Yeah.
And pooping. I mean, the lines have been crossed in so many areas that were taboo before, but this may be the last one. It is being broached. It's being breached in lots of different ways, in this movie, in this book, in other books, in organizations that are working to make sure that people have what they need, that people who menstruate have the products they need, the water, the privacy, the health care, all these things that are essential to a healthy menstrual life. So that's going on right now. It's going to take a long time. This is a very ancient taboo, and it's shared by cultures around the world, and it doesn't change overnight. And people have been talking about this. The first book that I found about this was written in 1972, I think. It's called The Curse. And in that preface, it says, well, at last now we're talking about it, so things will change. Well, nothing changed so much, but the conversation is much more widely disseminated now. It's all over TV. It's on women comedians in particular have gotten great material out of the menstrual myths and menstrual stigma and poking holes in it. And it's no longer the big secret that it was. It's still edgy. You know, I've been talking to people on the radio, and when men interview me, and they have, they feel like they say, I'm not sure I should be talking about this. And I say, oh, of course you shouldn't be talking about this. I'm thrilled that you're talking about this. You need to talk. We all need to talk about this.
We all need to talk about it.
Stop talking about it, and it becomes as normal as, you know, going to the bathroom. And that we're not having debates about toilet paper in the bathroom. And the presence of period products in all of our bathrooms should be just as normal as toilet paper in the bathroom.
That's right.
Mm. Anita, why don't you read a little bit from period, end of sentence?
So I'm going to read from the beginning, and the chapter's called The Curse. What's in a name? At any given moment, there are 800 million people menstruating on planet Earth, and as many as 5,000 euphemisms for menstruation in use. There are folksy ones like Aunt Flo, descriptive, on the rag, sweet, Germany's strawberry week, alarming, Finland's mad cow disease, historical from France, they have The English Have Landed, Familial, Little Sister in China, and Anecdotal from South Africa, Granny's Stuck in Traffic. Isn't that great? Period is the most common euphemism used around the world by people who speak Amharic, German, Russian, Spanish, and Xhosa, among others. And even though period refers only to the interval of time and doesn't hint at blood or bodies, people still drop their voices when the word comes up in conversation. Then there is the curse. Menstruation has been defined and described as a curse from ancient times to present. Stamped as truth by scholars, enforced by religious leaders, and passed down a miserable legacy through generations of women. As a result, for millions of people, cursed is an accurate description of how it feels to live in a body that bleeds. A curse is a magical formula or potion that does harm, like the death of a firstborn, princes into frogs, red hair. An illness or generational misfortune is sometimes called a curse. The curse is one and only one bloody thing. It identifies a necessary part of human reproduction as a malediction, and by extension, anyone who menstruates as a threat. From early on, Western civilization considered menstruation a threat. In first century Rome, the scholar Pliny the Elder wrote that contact with menstrual blood, quote, turns new wine sour, crops touched by it become barren, grafts die, seeds in gardens are dried up, the fruit of trees fall off, the edge of steel and the gleam of ivory are dulled. It goes on and on and on. If that sounds laughably outdated, in the 1920s, The Lancet, an esteemed medical journal, reported that the touch of menstruating women caused flowers to wilt. And in 1974, they doubled down with an article asserting that a permanent wave would not take in the hair of menstruating women. Periods can be uncomfortable, inconvenient, embarrassing, and all kinds of painful, from mild cramps to ones that keep you in bed for days. Periods are expensive, messy, and unpredictable. Comedian Michelle Wolf, the doyenne of period jokes, compares menstruation to an outdoor cat. Quote, you know it's coming back, you just don't know when. Menstruation is also a mark of maturity and a measure of health. Metaphorically and spiritually, it signals the continuity of human life. Stigma and powerlessness and silence can make it feel like punishment, but menstruation is not the curse. The curse is shame. I'll stop there.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
The curse is shame, and shame keeps us from health and from success and from self-confidence and fills us with self-doubt and fear and keeps us quiet.
Now, in the Western world, most women are probably not too impacted by this.
Oh. They are.
They are.
I mean, I think, go ahead, in developing countries and poor countries, it's much more dramatic.
Yes.
I know what you're talking about. So girls will stay home from school, girls will drop out of school, and in at least a few cases, girls who have been shamed at school for having a stain on their clothing have committed suicide. The shame is so great. And it's, girls tend to drop out of school more than boys for many reasons. Their parents don't think it's important. Once they start menstruating, they're marriageable. But also, there's a lack of understanding of what's happening. There's a lack of products. There's a lack of bathrooms, safe and bathrooms where they can take care of themselves, places to dispose of their products. And that has been a real, that hamstrings women and girls in very profound ways. And then not knowing what's happening to you, not knowing when you're sick, can lead to disease that goes untreated and can be devastating to the reproductive system and even to life itself. But I want to tell you that in your zip code, there is a high school girl someplace or a junior high school girl someplace whose family can't afford period products or enough period products. So she either goes to school with toilet paper stuffed in her pants and spends the whole day worrying about, is she going to stain? She's distracted. She can't concentrate. She's not going to try out for this beach team or the softball team because she's afraid that she will leave. And so there's a, and she's distracted and she's unsure and she's embarrassed all day long. So it's a different quiet kind of insidious problem, but it's everywhere. It's everywhere.
Well, that's true. And I was having a conversation with a friend my age who just this week who mentioned that she didn't know anything about periods when she started. Mm-hmm. She had been told nothing. And that's probably still the case in some places, that if the parents aren't telling them, the schools aren't telling them, and girls think they're dying.
Yeah, they do. They think they have cancer. They think there's something terribly wrong with them. And it's blood, and they're ashamed, and they don't know who to talk to. Or they think, the number of really incorrect beliefs is staggering. Some girls have been told that, and there is a belief that if you start your period, that means you've had sex. So you don't want to tell your father because then he'll beat you because he'll think you've had sex, which is, of course, ridiculous. But, and the lack of information is heartbreaking. Even in the United States, there's a great statistic in here. There's somebody said that girls say they knew more about the biology of frogs than their own reproductive systems by the time they graduated from high school. So
I believe it. And then, of course, the issues for refugees and homeless people and
incarcerated people, really.
That's just unbelievable to me. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's shocking. I mean, I learned a lot of shocking things when I was working on this book. But the way that menstrual products in prisons and jails are withheld, made almost impossible to purchase because folks don't have money. And they're sold in commissaries for outrageous prices for lousy products, which means, and women are supposed to keep themselves clean. You can get demerits if you bleed through your clothes. It's a nightmare. And there are many documented cases where guards have traded period products for sex. And it continues. And even when there are laws passed that say that menstrual products must be made available means... Many can be interpreted in many different ways. Available should mean free. This is not a luxury item. This is a necessity, as anybody who's ever had a period or anybody with any compassion will understand. This is not a choice. You have to have these products. And the idea that you have to pay for them when you're in prison and you have very limited money and you have to make a choice between calling your children and having a menstrual product, you make do with what you're given and with toilet paper. And sometimes you have to, debase yourself in incredible ways in order just to take care of your body. And it happens a lot. It's been, I have to say, as more and more women are elected to office throughout the country, and that includes city councils, state legislatures, bills that require there be menstrual products everywhere, and especially in prisons and jails, are being put forth all the time, and they're making their way through, and they're succeeding, and they are always introduced by female legislators. This is definitely the place where having representation in government makes an enormous difference.
I just feel it is such a shame that people are trying to profit off of the least, the most vulnerable, the people in prison have so little, and that people are trying to profit off of that by selling these products at high prices. They do the same thing with phone calls.
Yeah.
Phone calls cost inmates more than anyone else in the mm-hmm. country. They have to pay more for phone calls, and it should be the opposite. And even if it's not out of an empathy, it's like, don't you want people who are in prison, who are most of whom will someday get out, to maintain connections with their family?
Right, and dignity, and a sense of dignity.
And dignity,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's outrageous. But it's because it's been invisible for so long, because we who menstruate have been taught to be quiet about this because it's shameful, it's disgusting, it's gross. It's still a mystery. It's still a secret to many, many people, including a lot of men. So we really need a kind of mass education, which has to come, as you mentioned, from the home, from parents talking to kids, from family members talking to kids, and hopefully in school as well. And what I learned in this book was very important, is in all gender classrooms, how very important it is for everybody to learn about this stuff early, as I was taught by somebody, earlier than it's become, before it's personal, you know. So like in fourth grade, when you're getting health education, where it's just biology, you learn the language, because if we all have to have the same language, how can men and boys who have no idea what's going on gain any kind of empathy if this is a total mystery and it's talked about in whispers and laughed at? So if you can present it, you know, in school, in class, to your kids, as a matter of fact, this is part of life, and it's part of the miracle of life, with respect and using real words, I think we go a long way to correcting the terrible fact that this is still a curse.
Well, you know, another thing that I feel like we need to talk about more is perimenopause.
Oh, yes.
Because I had no idea. I know about menopause. Talked about that, but I had no idea about the last few years before menopause, what I was in for until I got there myself.
Oh, absolutely. The whole menstrual cycle. I mean, this book is focused largely on menstrual, the periods, people who are having menstrual cycles, and especially girls as they start. But the entire cycle is hushed up, and I have to recommend a book by Dr. Jen Gunter, which was just published, called The Menopause Manifesto, which includes a lot of information about perimenopause. And again, this is a book full of information. It's like 300 pages long. It's a great reference. You know, you look up what you need to know, but it's the first thing of its kind. And here we are, and, you know, it's the first kind of book.
2021.
That's right. It's been, we don't know enough about our bodies, and that's from beginning to end. And women tend to not talk about their pain, and their pain is often gaslighted by doctors saying, well, that's just normal, that kind of pain during one's period. Well, not always. So we really do need to talk to each other. We need to inform one another. We need to get the best information we can, and not let doctors tell us it's all in our heads.
Exactly. So, just a little bit, just tell us what type of content the book, you know, what all did you include in here? Because it's, you know, you have a certain structure, and just kind of run that down for us.
The table of contents sort of does it. The part one is about the curse and shame, and what shame costs us all. And in some parts of the world, it can be your life. In other parts of the world, it can be your livelihood. And then there's a chapter in that called Shamelessness, which talks about the efforts to talk about this, and how young people, really young, 13, 14, all the way through college, are leading the vanguard and refusing to be ashamed. The second part is about indigenous wisdom. So there are wonderful examples of indigenous cultures to this very day, and those that are being revived, that teach us that it doesn't have to be this way, that there are cultures where menarche, the beginning of menstruation, is celebrated in the whole community. Part three is about the struggle for to get rid of poverty, period poverty, to get rid of sales tax on tampons and pads. It's about menstruating in work and dignity, and that includes the struggle for women of color and poor women and women incarcerated. Part four is about menstruation being public. It's about men and menstruation, about the menstruation business, the products that are made by huge corporations, and also small companies started by women to make products that are environmentally friendly and respond to women's needs. So the book is sort of an omnibus overview of menstrual subjects today in the world we live in now.
Thank you, Anita, and thank you so much for being with us today. And next we're going to be welcoming Melissa Burton, who sort of got this ball rolling. And now, because Anita, since you started this project during COVID, did you get an opportunity to actually meet Melissa, or has that all been virtual too?
All virtual. I had an appointment. I had my plane ticket to go out to Los Angeles and meet with Melissa and other members of the PAD project, and nope, we had to cancel that. So someday I hope to meet them all in person. We've certainly had a lot of phone conversation, and it's been great to work with the PAP project, and especially with Melissa.
Well, thank you again. It's been great talking to you. And Melissa, I'm Monica Hadley, and we also have my mother, Caroline Kilborn, on the line. And
hi, so nice to meet you. Thank you for having me.
So nice to meet you, too. And so, Melissa, tell us how the PAD project got started.
So the PAD project got started when one of my high school students approached me to be the faculty advisor for an organization called Girls Learn International. Girls Learn International is an organization that seeks to give high school students a voice in the international movement for equal access to education for all genders. And as part of the initiative of Girls International, Girls Learn International, they send students, 16-year-old people, to be delegates at the Commission on the Status of Women held every year at the United Nations. And I was the faculty advisor for this trip to the United Nations, and it was there that we learned about period poverty, and we also learned about Murugan Anthem, the Indian inventor of the pad machine. And we decided, because we were in touch with another Girls Learn International chapter in northern India, that we, who wanted to pilot a pad machine, that we were going to fundraise to get the pad machine to our partner community in northern India. And also, we're going to somehow document the process on film so that other people would be made aware of this issue of period poverty.
Wow. So had you ever even thought about this issue before that?
No. And I think, to answer briefly, no. And I think maybe that's why I and all of my students were so moved. I don't think any of us, we had been familiar with our own privilege in many ways, you know, but we had never thought about privilege as meaning, oh, I can buy a tampon or pad. I know what's happening to my body when I get my period. I don't have to worry about going to an unsafe or unclean toilet. All of these things, which, by the way, are unavailable to many women right here in the United States. We just hadn't thought about it, and we were ashamed at our own ignorance about it. And we thought, okay, we've got to do something about it. We have to take action.
So you raised the money for this machine. How does this kind of work? How does the machine work, and who sort of takes responsibility for it?
Such great questions. So at the time, now it's about 8 years ago, when the machine that you see in the film, the documentary film, for any of your listeners, period, end of sentence, the machine in the documentary was the first really of its kind. And Murugan Anthem and Jayashree Industries were the only people making this machine, which is a very simple machine, looks like three blenders next to each other. We got to see the machine in action, and they make hygienic pads with a light, ultraviolet light that sanitizes the pads from locally sourced 93% biodegradable material. And so the women who are engaged in, it's like a pad factory, they make the pads and then they market and distribute the pads for more cheaply in this community than what they would get at a local marketplace if pads and tampons are even sold in a marketplace. Since the time that we got Murugan Anthem's pad machine, now a pad machine industry has sort of sprung up in India. So now there are four or five, I'm sure there are many more, but there are four or five different pad machine vendors. There are now automatic pad factories where they make many more pads per minute, but they're still kind of low tech compared to what you would think of automated. And so for instance, at the PAD project, we're really proud that we've just been able to put a pad making machine in a woman's collective maternity ward in Kabul in Afghanistan. And so the women are able, and the hospital has electricity, which means that the pads can generate, and electricity is a big issue when you're dealing with some rural areas in countries where you might need a manual pad machine. So it seems to be a good solution.
How did when the gentleman who invented this first pad machine was working on it, what kind of reaction did he get? Was he welcomed with open arms, or was it?
No, he has a whole fantastic story, which should be a movie, and in fact is a movie. And it's called Padman, and the most sort of handsome, sought-after Bollywood star plays Muruganatham in the film. But at the time, it was a lonely road. His wife, the story goes that his wife was walking through the house with a very dirty rag filled with blood. He said, "What is it?" She explained. He saw immediately that that was unsanitary and not safe for her health to use. And he said, "This is unacceptable. Why aren't you buying pads?" She said, "Don't you understand? Pads, fine, I can buy pads, but I can't buy enough to feed our family for a week. It's a choice between pads or old rags or food for the family. I'm going to choose the old rags." And he immediately thought, this is not okay. He went, and he is an inventing sort, and figured out a way to make a pad cheaply. He actually wore diapers and had kind of udders that he facsimilated from goat bladder that he squirted into like diapers as though he were having a period. Can you imagine? What a great guy.
And oh my
to
gosh.
Test absorbency. His wife was so ashamed of what he was doing. What a weirdo you are. She left him. She came back to him because, lo and behold, he invented this amazing pad machine. And again, shortlisted for the Nobel Prize, became a celebrity. So their marriage is back. But there was a rocky period on his road to discovery.
I wonder what it was about him, because I'm sure there have been millions of men who have seen that women are struggling with this and did absolutely nothing right about it. But what was it in him that made him
this? Just a wonderful, inventive, genius, empathic person. Yeah.
And have you had an opportunity to meet him in person?
I haven't. So like the United States, India is very large, and he lives in, so where the pad machine is in northern India. He lives in Coimbatore, which is like, it was like 4 hours away. So when we were filming, we couldn't, but we're really proud that we, our director, so I'm the producer of the film, one of the producers, and our director went, and I came to the site later when Muruganatham wasn't available, but I'm proud that our director got to film Muruganatham, and he has, you know, one of my favorite lines in the film, which is, "The strongest creature created by God in the world, not the lion, not the tiger, not the elephant, but the girl."
Oh.
Yeah. It's great, and I'm proud that we have the real Muruganatham in our film, who I think, I love the Bollywood star, but I think we got the real guy.
The real deal. Yeah. And were you involved in the second film at all? Was that?
You mean
the Padman?
Oh, no. No. The funny thing was that when my students and I, so I traveled to Kathikera to screen the film for the first time for the women in the village. who had been operating the machines. And at that very same time, some of the original PAD Project students that we were doing that, Padman was playing at the local theaters in Delhi. The place where the machine was is in a village, and we're like, we got to go see this. But we were so we couldn't actually make time because it was just a hugely packed itinerary. But when I got home, I was able to see it on Netflix, and it's a wonderful, fun film.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guests today were Anita Diamond, and now we're talking with Melissa Burton. Anita wrote Period, End of Sentence, and Melissa is the Academy Award-winning producer of the film by the same name and the executive director of the PAD Project. So that's your full-time occupation now.
It is a full-time. I have two occupations, like women in the world, but I'm also a high school English teacher. So, and that's
how... Oh, you're still teaching?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. My gosh. So my, and Caroline was a high school English teacher.
Right.
Yeah.
So Mom, did you ever have, I remember you telling me about how you always would let your female students, take extra long in the bathroom if they needed to.
Oh yeah.
Love that.
It's all, you know, you have to give them a hall pass, you know, and I would gladly do that. I mean that, or I tell them if they were late to class, you know, I didn't question them because I figured they probably had a good reason. So, you know, I didn't realize at the time that, that I was doing a kindness, but I know now that I was, because that was, you know, it was just, I had an inkling that girls had problems, and I don't think there were, I don't think there were any products in the restrooms at school. I'm sure there weren't. So I don't know whether they got them at the nurses, where the nurses could give them to them if they didn't have them. I never had any girls in my class that their period came and they weren't prepared, you know, with a stain on their clothing. I don't remember ever having that, thank God. But because it would be, you know, it would really be, I can imagine what, I can't imagine what it would be like. But, well, see, I had fibroid tumors as an adult, and so I had a lot of bleeding and a lot of, you know, that, and I know what that's like to be afraid every minute that you're on your feet if, you know, if something's going to happen, you're going to have an accident and so forth. So it's really hard on the psyche for women, and I don't think men don't really understand that. They can't possibly understand that. And I'm wondering now, you gals that worked with men making this film, did they how did that go? How did that?
It went wonderfully in most cases. We had producing partners who were men, fathers who served in support of their daughters who served the PAD Project and the film process by way of being accountants and legal advisors. And I think I had many kind fathers tell me, you know, I'm so glad to be in this process with my daughter because now it's something I can talk about. It's a part of her life that's important that I had felt so sort of shut out from. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad now to be able to have an open conversation. There are other men who have disdain and disgust for the topic, and we certainly met that. A story I tell is that the Hollywood Reporter, a week before the Oscar, they published this anonymous opinions, who's going to get the Oscar in each category. And this is actually like a Vegas thing. People take bets, they vote. And the members of the Academy, who are the people who vote, publish their, you know, put their odds down and publish what they think is going to win. And one self-proclaimed longstanding male director of the Academy said, no one will ever vote for a film about menstruation because that is just too icky. None of my male friends.
Oh.
We will never vote. So I'm glad we're here to him now.
Oh. So, oh, wow. So how did you actually how did the film get nominated, and what was it like going to the Oscars?
Oh, my God. It was so amazing. Wow. What a crazy experience. It is like that book, The Little Engine That Could. We had made this film. We scraped together fundraising projects from every corner we had. We had a Kickstarter campaign. We had bake sales. We did yoga-thons. We were these high school students and their teachers trying to raise money not only to get a pad machine, but to make this film. We had a lot of luck, connections, kind people wanting to support, and we got our film. We made, you know, enough money to make the film, to get the pad machine, and we started going out on the film festival circuit, which is something you apply for just to even get into a festival. And we were like, every time we got into a film festival, we were like, wow, we got into a film festival. Who can go to Arkansas? Who can go to Northern California? Who can go to Seattle? And we went with our team, and what we started noticing is that we were winning two different kinds of awards. And one award is called the Audience Award, which means that the audience votes for your film to win. And another award is the Jury Award. And we were getting both of those. And because of that, we started to think, wow, you know, this film is really actually resonating with people. And so we were submitted, you're automatically submitted into a larger pool to be nominated for the Oscars if you win enough film festivals, which we did. And these were little film festivals. And then the morning, I live in Los Angeles, so I'm sort of aware of these things around me, but the morning of the Oscars, they make the announcements of who is actually nominated in the final five. And that happens at 5 in the morning so that the press magazines can like announce it, you know, during that news cycle day. And we all gathered in my student's basement. We watched on a TV as the news reporter read the nominations, and we were just like, ah! And my students and I jumped up, and we came to school that day, and we're nominated, we made it. So it was crazy.
So Caroline's on the phone, so she can't see this, but because I've got you on camera, you got your little gold statue back there.
I do. It's the best, accessory for whatever this time of life we have right now. A remote.
Yeah. So, you got to go to the awards presentation. And did some of your students get to come too?
They did. They certainly did. And if you like, I don't know, if you Google period, end of sentence, wins Oscar, whatever, you'll see the students who were the original PAD Project students who now work with me at the PAD Project and are part of our marketing team. You see them running up to the stage and hugging each other behind me. They ran to get there and celebrate, and I'm so glad they could do that. And then we also had our guests from India who were there at the Academy Awards that night. Unfortunately, where they were seated, I was surprised my students could get there, but they would have had to fly to the stage, but I wish they could have. They probably almost could have. We were also thrilled. Yeah.
That's wonderful. I mean, that must have been just an amazing moment.
It was.
An amazing moment.
Body.
Yeah. Now, did you have any filmmaking experience before?
No.
So how did you learn how to make a movie?
So I have personally some screenwriting experience, which, by the way, is not, you don't really need screenwriting experience to make a documentary film. But I suppose as an English teacher, I understand the value of story as a, you know, so I understood about the importance of having people in the film like Sneha, the aspiring police officer, who we're going to care about, who we're going to follow, the importance of having that arc. But what I did, what many enterprising women do, is that I was not afraid to ask, not afraid to delegate, and I knew we had to get our message across in the most effective way possible. So my students and I just tapped everyone we know. Oh, you have experience editing film and you look at this cause. Wouldn't you want to help? Yes, I would. Oh, you have a production team in India. Could you help? Yes, I could. So that little engine that could thing really happened. And I do not give myself credit for that. That is the, I think that when young people, as your mom knows, remembering being a teacher, I think that when young people are really impassioned about something and reach out for help, they're maybe more likely to get that help than an adult asking, just because it's there's something so authentic about it.
Well, that's a good point. And probably maybe some of the students had parents who were in the industry. And had connections So now it's fascinating to me that a number of them have made this their career.
That's right.
That's fantastic. So what are some of the things the PAD Project is doing now?
So currently the PAD Project has 9 since the Academy Award Netflix release for Period End of Sentence, we have been able to place 9 more PAD machines in 4 different countries. Next year, we have 8 more PAD machines in 13 different countries. This now includes East Africa, so Kenya, Uganda, Zanzibar. We have what's called a washable PAD program, which is a different model where people wash and dry pads and they can reuse them. This requires a particular climate, which is why it's not a good solution everywhere, but it's a great solution some places. So we have washable pad programs in Ghana, Sierra Leone, Guatemala, Uganda, and we also give domestically in the U.S. to homeless shelters, domestic abuse shelters, foster care, detention centers on the border where PADs are not accessible. We work with a group called Border Angels. In schools, we have a PADs for All campaign, which gives PADs to people who go to school who can't afford them, which is many people in the United States. We're working with school districts in Southern California and in Colorado right now. So,
wow. So that's a lot. Well, I was going to ask you about the reusable pads, because there is a concern about the environmental impact of disposable pads. For me, having grown up with tampons and disposable pads, the idea of reusable pads seems icky. But I feel like it's probably the right thing to do. I mean, I've switched from using disposable napkins to using washable, you know, napkins, cloth napkins. I hardly use paper towels anymore. I use microfiber things I can rewash. So how do we get past this? But I still haven't. I know there's this product out there that instead of facial tissues to blow your nose, it's like this handkerchief thing that goes into this other side and then you wash. But I still have a problem with that too. So how do we get past this?
There's menstrual cups. Menstrual cups are like a silicone kind of cup that catches the blood that you can rinse out and reuse, and therefore is environmentally friendly. The issue with those for some of the countries that we work with is that insertion of anything is akin to losing one's virginity. And since a woman's worth is still in many places around the world tied to her virginity, that is a method that is frowned upon. Another barrier for that method is that while over time it's a cost saver, because it's one thing, initially they're about $40, which is just sort of unthinkable for many women in the U.S. who might choose that option. However, there are many communities and women around the world who are moving to a kind of menstrual cup, which is great. Then there are like the period underwear, like Spanx, as I'm conflating Spanx and Spanx. It's like Spanx,
yeah.
And those you can wash. So washable pads or reusable pads turns out to be an issue that's more complicated than it might seem. Even if you get over the feeling like, oh, this seems icky, you have to be in a community, not just with good, clean water, but also a community where it can dry in direct sunlight, and you have enough sunlight. So, for instance, in many of the communities we work in India, there's monsoons and the weather's too wet and there would never be a time. There's also the issue of, are you going to be hanging stained pads, even, you know, in direct sunlight out in the open? Is that going to be an issue that might cause shaming, which we wouldn't want? So right now, I feel like the holy grail is a kind of 100% biodegradable disposable pads. Pads seem to be the most culturally sensitive solution. And when you think about the pads from the machine are, you know, there's just this very little bit of plastic. I know anything that doesn't biodegrade, but I say get everyone a pad, and then some young woman who can go to school because she's wearing a pad is going to be some killer scientist, and she's going to invent a 100% biodegradable pad. But I feel like, you know, first things first, we need to care about the environment, but we also need to not deny women their full and equal rights as citizens because we're going to be worried about her choice of, you know, menstrual care. Let's get to menstrual care first, and then let's solve the next together.
Wow. That is an excellent point. We need to care about the environment, but let's get the basics covered.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. So, Mom, before we close, do you have any more questions for Melissa?
Well, I just want to compliment her on her, you know, being so dedicated to this and making sure that this film got done. I mean, it's just amazing to me that they've made this progress, and I hope that we can continue to make it in countries where it's still such a shameful thing. And so I just compliment everybody who's worked on this. It's really great.
And let's get rid of sales tax on this.
Come on!
My
at
gosh!
Least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at least. I mean...
Yeah, 20 states left to... 30 states left to go.
Seriously, many? Wow. And is that something the PAD Project is working
Absolutely.
On?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, there's no reason for that.
No.
I do have something else too I'd like to say. In this time, due to COVID, some people don't have extra money, but as a kindness, we should make sure that there are pads in the restrooms where we work, where we attend church, or in public restrooms.
100%.
Any place that you feel they might be needed, we can.
That's right. That is right. And we're definitely working toward that too, and attitudes changing toward that. Really, if you think about it, it should be as accessible as toilet paper. I mean, you shouldn't have to stress about that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because we all of us women remember times.
Of course.
When, oh my gosh, my period started, I wasn't expecting it. How do I find something? And I think most of us have at one time or another given a tampon to a stranger, given a pad to a stranger in a public restroom, and felt really good being able to do that.
Right.
Well, thank you once again for being with us, Melissa. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure meeting you and your mom. Go English teachers.
Well, that's right.
That's great. I love
that's
it.
That's right. And keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And see you all next week on Writer's Voice.
Wonderful. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.